Let me repeat, Ed. Can you hear? Are you hearing me this way or this way? Or both? I'll be looking at this because I have to read this. I want to read a couple of verses, or maybe just one, from the Psalms that Phil used tonight. It was particularly appropriate, I think, for Van Gogh. Lord, all my desire is before thee. My groaning is not hid from thee. That will become more apparent as the evening rolls on. I want to do four things tonight, or have four little parts to the evening. The first is I'll give you a little brief biography of Vincent van Gogh. Then I want to introduce you to the format and the reason for the structure of the evening. And then, most of the time, I'll be reading Vincent's letters. And since it's possible to misinterpret the last letter and the last couple of slides, particularly if you get all wrapped up in it as I do, I usually get pretty choked up by the time I get the last letter, then I want to have about a 2-minute epilogue at the end. Why don't we try it with the doors open because it'll keep us a little cooler? Vincent van Gogh, born 1853, had five brothers and sisters. His father was a minister. At 16, he went to live with and work with an uncle, after whom he'd been named, Uncle Vincent, who was an art dealer. And for 7 years, until he was 23, 24, he worked as a minor official in the art dealer's agency in The Hague, in London, and in Paris. At 24, he had a strong compulsion to become a minister. One of the problems was the route to the ministry at that time was exclusively through the university, and Van Gogh was far from being a sufficient scholar to earn his right to become a minister in that way. So he went and studied with a private teacher in order to solve this problem. In 1878, when he was 24, at the beginning of his 24th year, he was a volunteer worker in the Boronage area. This is an area in the south of Belgium, a very poor district, coal miners by and large. One of the letters will talk about this. He'll show you a drawing of one of the miners. And then the subsequent 12 months, he received 2 6-month probationary appointments as an evangelist from evangelist training school in the area. But by the end of the second 6-month period, he was removed. He was removed, and I think this is extremely significant because we'll read this into his paintings too. He was removed because he had read in his devotion to the scriptures that if you had a cloak, and you found somebody didn't have a cloak, you gave it to him. And he read if you had some money and you found somebody didn't have any money, you gave it to him. And similarly, if you had a lot of time and you found somebody needed your time and your energy, you gave it to him. As a result, when the inspectors came down from the evangelist training school to see how he was doing, he found a guy in very bad physical shape because he'd given away his clothes and his money. He looked awful. And his time had been so spent in the service of others that his health and his spirit were pretty far down. It's obvious you can't have a minister who doesn't look good, and one doesn't eat well. So he was sacked in the sense that he was not even given any permanent appointment. Meanwhile, he had been doing some drawing, and remembering the experiences that he'd had with his uncle, the art dealer, and by 1880, the following year, he had begun to support himself with odd jobs. Every now and then, some of his drawings were sold. Early in the 80s, his brother, Theo, to whom all the letters I'll read tonight were written, began to support him. His brother was now working in the same art dealer's concern, the uncle, that Vincent had worked in a couple of years earlier. Until 1888, he remained in Paris. During this time, he met most of the artists of the day, Pissarro, Signac, Bernard, Gauguin, and many of you maybe saw the movie with, Kirk Douglas, in which rather faithful representation was made of the relationship between Gauguin and Van Gogh. And he also met many picture dealers, one of whom I'll refer to tonight, Tanguy. By February of 88, he had decided that Paris was not for him, and he made a journey to the sun, literally, symbolically, passionately, and he moved south to Arles. On Christmas Eve, he had the famous argument with Gauguin, which resulted in the ear bit, where he cut off a fraction of the lobe and put it in a box and took it around, dropped it on the front door of a young lady prostitute. In February of the following year, February the 9th, he had a breakdown and entered into a hospital. About 2 weeks later, after he had come out of the hospital, the townspeople of Arles had him recommitted to a mental institution at Saint-Rémy. And he was in and out of this for about a year, having a relapse in 1889, in July. And for the following year, he painted a lot, but painted mostly indoors. The illness of Vincent is much in dispute, although I gather that the consensus today is he simply had a form of epilepsy. And at that time, epilepsy was not really identified correctly, and those of you who had experience with people who have seizures realize that it's very frightening. It's particularly frightening in view of the kind of mythology that is created about insane people. A few days in mid-May of 1890, he went to Paris to visit his brother, and there he went a few miles north, and in July of 1890, he shot himself. Tonight, with no exception, I want to read the letters that he wrote to Theo. He wrote great numbers of them, three volumes, to many people. The ones to Theo are by far the most important for us. Most of those I have edited tonight. I've edited them not in changing the word, but simply in abridging them in an attempt to give you a perspective of Vincent van Gogh and to remove some of the redundancy which occurs in letter after letter. Sometimes I will read whole letters. I will try always to read a beginning and an ending so you'll get a sense of it. Sometimes the work I'll be reading, the letter I'll be reading, will be related to the painting on the screen, and sometimes not. I'm not interested in any one-to-one relationship being made between the letter and the painting or the drawing. I'm really interested in simply giving you a perspective of the personality of Vincent van Gogh through these two areas, his writing and his painting. You can gain a little bit of participation value if you want to play the game as I read and try to tie it up with the painting, but don't push it too far. I'll read names of individuals, names of books, magazines, places. I won't identify them. I don't think it's relevant in this presentation to identify them. I simply want to give you the flavor of the idea, the kind of the color of that part of the idea that the letter might be involved with. I'm similarly not interested in presenting a development of Vincent van Gogh as an artist. This will, though, be pretty obvious to you because I'll be reading the letters and presenting the material to you in a chronologically oriented way. A couple of small notes before I begin reading. The early part of the hour will find you doing a lot more listening than reading, so bear with me. The reason for this is 90% of Vincent van Gogh's art was done in the last 2 years of his life. As a result, you'll see some drawings, a few paintings at the beginning, and then at the end, with a rush, will come the majority of the works I want to illustrate tonight. I'm going to begin with a long letter to Theo, written in July of 1880. This is a kind of capsule self-assessment. It's about himself, statements of knowing, and statements of questioning. There are also some statements of anxiety present, and some statements of fulfillment. In brief, it's really a letter about a human being, by a human being, with the same kind of spirit that we have. The main difference, of course, being that this particular spirit, Vincent van Gogh, has a much greater capability than most of us possess of expressing that particular spirit. Dear Theo, I'm writing you with some reluctance, not having done so in such a long time for many reasons. To a certain degree, you've become a stranger to me, and I've become the same to you, more than you may think. Perhaps it would be better for us not to continue in this way. Probably I would not have written you even now if I were not under the obligation and necessity of doing so, if you yourself hadn't given me the cause. At Eton, I learned that you had sent 50 francs to me. Well, I have accepted them, certainly with reluctance, certainly with a rather melancholy feeling, but I'm up against a stone wall in a sort of a mess. How can I do otherwise? So I'm writing to thank you. Perhaps you know I'm back in the Voronezh. Father would say, and he would rather say, that I would stay here in the neighborhood of Eton. I refused, and in this, I think I acted for the best. Involuntarily, I've become more or less a kind of impossible and suspect personage in the family, at least somebody whom they do not trust. So how could I in any way be of any use to anybody? Therefore, above all, I think the best and most reasonable thing for me to do is to go away and keep at a convenient distance so that I can cease to exist for you all, as molting time, when they change their feathers, is for birds. So adversity or misfortune is a difficult time for us human beings. One can stay in it, in that time of molting. One can also emerge renewed, but anyhow, it must not be done in public, and it's not at all amusing. Therefore, the only thing to do is to hide oneself. So be it. Now I must bore you with certain abstract things. I hope you'll listen to them patiently. I'm a man of passion. I'm capable of and subject to doing more or less foolish things which I happen to repent, more or less afterwards. Now and then, I speak and I act too hastily, when it would have been better to wait patiently. I think other people sometimes make the same mistake. Well, this being the case, what's to be done? Must I consider myself a dangerous man, incapable of anything? I don't think so. But the problem is to try every means to put those self-same passions to good use. For instance, to name one of the passions, I have a more or less irresistible passion for books. And I continually want to instruct myself, to study if you like, just as much as I want to eat my bread. You certainly will be able to understand this. When I was in other surroundings, in the surroundings of pictures and the works of art, you know how I had a violent passion for them, reaching the highest pitch of enthusiasm. And I'm not sorry about it, for even now, far from that land, I'm often homesick for the land of pictures. You remember perhaps that I knew well, perhaps I still know, who Rembrandt was, or Millet, or Jules Dupré, or Delacroix, or Millet, or Mathieu Marie. Well, I don't have those surroundings anymore. Yet that thing called soul, they say it never dies, but lives on and continues to search forever and ever and ever. So instead of giving way to this homesickness, I said to myself, that land, or the fatherland, is everywhere. So instead of giving in to despair, I chose the part of active melancholy, insofar as I possess the power of activity. In other words, I prefer the melancholy which hopes and aspires and seeks to that which despairs in stagnation and woe. So I studied somewhat seriously the books within my reach, like the Bible, The French Revolution by Michelet, last winter, Shakespeare, and a few by Victor Hugo, Dickens, Beecher Stowe, and lately Aeschylus. And then several others, less classical, several great little masters. You know, the little masters, they include people like Fabricius or Beda. Well, now for 5 years, more than 5 years, I don't know exactly how long, I've been more or less without employment, wandering here and there. You say, since a certain time you've gone down, you have deteriorated, you have not done anything. But is that true? It is true that occasionally I have earned my crust of bread, and occasionally a friend has given it to me in charity. I have lived as I could, as luck would have it, haphazardly. It is true that I've lost the confidence of many. It is true that my financial affairs are in a sad state. It's true that the future is only too gloomy. It's true I might have done better. It's true that I've lost time in terms of eating my bread. It's true that even my studies are in a rather sad, hopeless condition, and my needs are greater, infinitely greater than my possessions. But is that what you call going down? Is that what you call doing nothing? You'll perhaps say, well, why didn't you continue as they wanted you to? Go to the university. Well, my only answer is expenses were too heavy. Besides, that future was not much better than the one on the road now before me. I must continue on the path I have now taken. If I don't do anything, if I don't study, if I don't go on seeking any longer, I'm lost. And woe is me. That's how I look at it. To continue. That's what's necessary. But you'll ask, what is your aim? Well, if that aim becomes definite, we'll stand out slowly and surely as the rough draft becomes a sketch, as the sketch becomes a picture, little by little, by working seriously on it, by pondering over the idea, vague at first, over the thought that was fleeting and passing, till it gets fixed. I must tell you that with evangelists, it's the same as with artists. There's an old academic school, often detestable, tyrannical, accumulation of horrors, men who wear a cuirass, steel armor, prejudice, conventions. When these people are in charge of affairs, they dispose of physique, and by a system of red tape, they try to keep their protégés in their places and to exclude the other men. Their gods like the god of Shakespeare's drunken Falstaff, the inside of the church. Indeed, by curious chance, some of these evangelical gentlemen, if you can call them evangelicals, find themselves at the same point of view on spiritual things as that drunken character. Perhaps they'd be somewhat surprised to discover this, that they were capable of human emotions. But there's little fear of their blindness ever changing to clear-sightedness in such matters. So you must not think that I disavow things. I'm rather faithful in my unfaithfulness, and though changed, I am the same. My only anxiety is, how can I be of use in the world? Can't I serve some purpose, be of some good? How can I learn more and study certain subjects profoundly? You see, that's far from participating in certain work, and certain necessities are beyond my reach. I feel imprisoned by poverty. That's one reason for being somewhat melancholy. And when one feels an emptiness where there might be friendship and strong and serious affections, and one feels a terrible discouragement gnawing at one's very moral energy, and fate seems to put a barrier to the instinct of affection, and a choking flood of disgust envelops one, and one exclaims, how long, my God? Well, what'll I say? Do our inner thoughts ever show outwardly? There may be a great fire in our soul, yet no one ever comes to warm himself at it. And the passers-by see only a wisp of smoke coming through the chimney, and they go along their way. Look here now, what must be done? Must one tend that inner fire, have salt in oneself, wait patiently, yet with how much impatience for the hour when somebody will come and sit down near it, maybe to say, let him who believe in God wait for the hour that will come sooner or later. For the moment, it seems that things are going very badly with me. It has already been so for a considerable time, may continue a while in the future. But after everything has seemed to go wrong, perhaps the time will come when things will go right. I don't count on it. Perhaps it'll never happen. But if there's a change for the better, I should consider it so much gain, I should be contented, and I'd say, at last, you see, there was something after all. I always think that the best way to know God is to love many things. Love a friend, a wife, something, whatever you like. You'll be on the way to knowing more about Him. That's what I say to myself. But one must love with a lofty and serious, intimate sympathy, with strength and intelligence. And one must always try to know deeper and better and more. That leads to God. That leads to unwavering faith. I write sometime at random whatever comes to my pen. I should be very glad if you could see in me something more than an idle fellow. Because there are two kinds of idleness, which are a great contrast to each other. There's the man who's idle from laziness and lack of character, from the baseness of his nature. If you like, you may take me for one of those. On the other hand, there's the idle man who is idle in spite of himself, who inwardly is consumed by a great longing for action, but he does nothing, because it's impossible for him to do anything, because he seems to be imprisoned in some cage, because he doesn't possess what he needs to become productive, because circumstances bring him inevitably to that point. Such a man does not always know what he should do, but he instinctively feels, I am good for something. If I ever can do anything for you, be some use to you, know that I am at your disposal. As I have accepted what you've given me, you might, in case I could render you some service, ask me to. It would make me happy. And I should consider it proof of confidence. We are rather far apart. Perhaps we have different views, on some things anyway. But nevertheless, there may come an hour, there may come a day, when we may be of service to one another. For the present, I shake hands with you, thanking you again for the help you've given me. If you wish to write to me one of these days, my address is care of Charles de Crook, Rue de Pavillon 3, Coisem, near Mont. Know that a letter from you will do me good. Ever yours, Vincent. From Quiz, 24th September, 1880. Dear Theo, your letter has done me good. I thank you for having written the way you did. The roll containing a new collection of etchings, various prints, has just arrived, especially the splendid etching Le Buisson by Daubigny and Riesdorf. That's it. I intend to make two drawings, either in sepia or in something else, one after that etching, the other after the four and the landscape by Rousseau. It's true, I've already done a sepia of the latter, but you know it lacks power compared with the etching by Daubigny. Though the sepia itself may have some tone and sentiment, I must take it up again and work on it. Last winter, I saw Courier. I'd undertaken a walking tour, mostly in the Pas-de-Calais. I'd said to myself, you must see Courier. I only had 10 francs in my pocket. I'd started taking a train, but I was soon out of money. I was on the road for a week, had a very long, weary walk of it. Anyhow, I saw Courier and the outside of Monsieur Jules Breton's studio. The outside of the studio was rather disappointing. It was quite newly built of brick with a Methodist regularity, an inhospitable, chilly, irritating aspect. If I could only have seen the interior, I would certainly not have given a thought to the exterior, I'm sure of that. But what shall I say of the interior? I wasn't able to catch a glimpse. I lacked the courage to enter and introduce myself. Another thing I saw during the excursion were the villages of the weavers. The miners and the weavers still constitute a race apart from other laborers and other artisans. I feel a great sympathy for them. I should be very happy if someday I could draw them so that those unknown, little-known types would be brought before the eyes of the people. The man from the depths of the abyss, de profundis. That's the miner. The other, with his dreamy air, somewhat absent-mindedly, almost a somnambulist. That's the weaver. I've been living among them for 2 years. I've learned a little of their unique character, at least that of the miners especially. Increasingly, I find something touching and almost sad in these poor, obscure laborers of the lowest order, so to speak, and the most despised. They're generally represented as a race of criminals and thieves by perhaps vivid but very false and unjust imagination. Of course, one can find criminals and drunkards and thieves here, just as anywhere else. But none of them are the true type. So every day, difficulties crop up and new ones present themselves. I can't tell you how happy I am to have taken up drawing again. I've been thinking of it for a long time. I always considered the thing impossible and beyond my reach. But now, though I feel my weakness and my painful dependence in many things, I have recovered my mental balance, and day by day, my energy increases. Thank you for your kindness, especially for Le Buisson. I shake hands with you in thought. Ever yours, Vincent. July the 31st, 1882. Dear Theo, just a line to welcome you in anticipation of your arrival. Also to acknowledge the receipt of your letter and the enclosed, for which I send my warmest thanks. It was very welcome, for I'm hard at work and I need a few more things. As I understand it, we of course agree completely about black in nature. Absolute black does not really exist. But like white, it is present in almost every color and forms the endless variety of grays, different in tone, different in strength, so that in nature one really sees nothing but tones or shades. There are only three fundamental colors, red, yellow, and blue, composites, orange, green, and purple. By adding black and some white, one gets the endless varieties of grays. Red gray, yellow gray, blue gray, green gray, orange gray, violet gray. It's impossible to say, for instance, how many green grays there are. There's an endless variety. But the whole chemistry of colors is no more complicated than those few simple rules, and having a clear notion of this is worth more than 70 different colors of paint. Because with those three principal colors, in black and white, one can make more than 70 tones and varieties. The colorist is a man who knows at once how to analyze a color, when he sees it in nature and can say, for instance, that green gray is yellow with black and blue, etc., etc. In other words, the man who knows how to find nature's grays on his palette. In order to take notes from nature, or to make little sketches, a strongly developed feeling for outline is absolutely necessary, as well as for intensifying of drawing later. I believe one does not acquire this without effort, but first by observation, and particularly by strenuous work and research, and special study of anatomy and perspective is necessary too. When I see such results, I feel the great importance of the outline, even more strongly, you know, from other drawings that I've made. I take a great deal of trouble to make progress in that respect. You will see when you come to the studio that apart from seeking the outline, I have, just like everybody else, a feeling for the power of color, that I do not object to doing watercolors, but their foundation is the drawing, and then many other branches sprout from the drawing besides the watercolor. This will develop in me in time, as in everybody who loves his work. I have attacked that old giant of a pollard willow. I think it's the best of the watercolors, a gloomy landscape, that dead tree near a stagnant pool, covered with reeds, in the distance a car shed of the Rhine Railway Company, the tracks cross each other, dingy black buildings, green meadows, a cinder path, sky with scudding clouds, gray with a single bright white border, depths of blue where the clouds are momentarily rent apart. In short, I wanted to make it the way the signal man in his smock with his little red flag must see and feel it when he thinks it's a gloomy weather day today. I've worked with great pleasure these last days, so now and then I still feel the effects of my illness. I hope you'll understand that I continue to stick to drawing for two reasons. First of all, I want to get a firm hand for drawing, and second, because painting and watercolor create a great many expenses in which there is no immediate return. Those expenses double and redouble 10 times over when one works on a drawing, which isn't correct enough. If I got into debt or surrounded myself with canvases and papers all daubed with paint without being sure of my drawing, then my studio would soon become a sort of hell, as I've seen some studios look. Now I always enter it with pleasure and work there with animation. But I don't believe that you suspect me of unwillingness. This is approximately the effect of the pollard willow. Only in the watercolor itself, there's no black other than a broken tone. In the watercolor, the strongest effect, dark green, brown, gray, they're where the black is darkest in this little sketch. Well, adieu. And believe me, sometimes I laugh heartily because people suspect me of all kinds of malignity and absurdities which I shouldn't dream of. I, who am really nothing but a friend of nature, a study of work, especially of people. Well, hoping to see you soon, with a handshake, yours sincerely, Vincent. Two, dear Theo, just a word to ask you whether you received my last letter, as well as a little roll, also sent by mail, containing a proof of a lithograph. The reason I can't help suspecting it didn't reach you but got lost, or that your letter got lost, is that I haven't heard from you since then. And besides, today's already November the 14th. For the last 5 or 6 days, I've been literally without money. Consequently, I can't go on with my work, at least not as I should wish. I think the reason is that you want to send me, along with your letter and the money, the information I asked you for about the lithographic process and the autographic ink, and that you had to wait for it. I hope perhaps today it'll be explained that way. But on the other hand, I'm always nervous when something like this happens, and I feel anxious. Then I'm afraid of having written or done something which you don't approve of. So last night, I worried about it. Perhaps you didn't approve of my having had my lithograph printed. Perhaps you would have concluded from my letter I intend to publish my work or something like that. Well, I was anxious, thinking something had happened, but, well, probably nothing is wrong. For safety's sake, however, I tell you, you must not confuse publication with experiments made to learn a process. On what was left of the printing paper, I made another trial last week with the little figure of sorrow. Just now, when I said I was afraid you would suspect from my last letter something that was not my intention, I was remembering I said something like, this is what I should like, to have some of these sheets printed at our own expense, which would give us more prestige with the editors of magazines. Now, my idea is by no means that either you or I should handle the business part if we undertook the printing at our own expense. I did not, and I shouldn't think of that for a moment. I just think that when one applies for a job, it's well to have some work to show. It saves words. Besides, it's more practical. When I used the above quoted sentence in my last letter, what I meant was that someday you would see my intentions more clearly in my drawings. In print, because of the lithographic crayon, they are all, especially sorrow, much stronger than the drawings. And just because the originals are kept gray and sober, I've only to follow my study to get vigor into my lithograph. This might be something which I should have to point out to people with whom I must get in touch if I could get some work for a magazine. Well, if you haven't written, do so at once when you receive this, for I'm rather hard up. Adieu, with a handshake. Yours sincerely, Vincent. Dear Theo, I received your letter just now, coming home from the dunes behind Lutzingen, wet through, for I'd been sitting in the rain for about 3 hours on a spot where everything was reminiscent of Roycal, Daubigny, or Jules Dupré. I came back with the study of twisted, gnarled little trees, and another one of a farm after the rain. Everything is already bronze-colored. Everything is what one would see in nature only during this time of the year, or when one looks at some pictures by Dupré, for instance. It's so beautiful that one's imagination always falls short of it. For me, the drama of storm in nature, the drama of sorrow in life, is the most impressive. A peridot, that's beautiful. But Gethsemane is even more beautiful. Oh, there must be a little bit of light, a little bit of happiness. Just enough to indicate the shape, to make the lines of the silhouette stand out. But let the whole be gloomy. I must say, the woman is bearing up well. She's unhappy about it, as I am, but she's not disheartened, and she keeps busy. I just brought a piece of material to make study linen of, and now I've given it to her to make underwear for the kids. Some of my things can be altered for them, too, so that she'll not leave me empty-handed. So she's very busy sewing these things. When I say we part as friends, it's true, but the parting is final. And after all, I'm more resigned than I thought I'd be, because her faults were such that it would have been a fatal thing to be bound together. For me as well as for herself, because one is, so to speak, responsible for one another's faults. So I ask myself anxiously, how will she be in a year? I shall certainly never take her into my house again, but I don't want to lose sight of her, for I'm too fond of her and the children. For the very reason that it was and is a feeling other than passion, this is possible too. But I hope I shall be able to leave something behind for the woman to help her through the first week. That as soon as I can go, I will. I tell you that I intend to help the woman a little at first. I may not do much, nor can I. But I mention this only to you, and you may depend on it that whatever may happen to her, I neither can nor ever will live with her again. For she is just incapable of doing what she ought to do. I also drop Father a line to tell him that I parted company with her. But for all that, my letter to Father about my continuing to be true to her and being willing to marry her remains a fact. Another fact is that Father avoided the issue at the time and didn't reply to the fundamental question. I don't know how it will appear to me in later years, for instance, whether this might not have been better than leaving her. Now we are too close to the facts to get the right view of the basic interrelation and the consequences of all things. I do hope everything will come out all right. But her future, as well as my own, looks gloomy. I'm inclined to believe there's some latent good in her still, but the trouble is, it ought to have been aroused already. Now, I see there's nobody to rely on. It'll be more difficult for her to follow her good impulse. If she could only find a man who was not altogether bad, that'd do it. The foundation was laid here, then it would then develop, namely that of a more domestic, simpler disposition. If she sticks to that, in the future, I need not leave her quite to her fate. For then at least I remain her friend, and a true one, too. Well, Write again soon, and believe me. Yours sincerely, Vincent. Dear Theo, as to the work, I'm working on a rather large picture of a weaver. The loom seen from the front, the little figure, dark silhouette against the white wall. At the same time, I'm working on another one, which I began last winter, a loom on which a piece of red cloth is being woven. There the loom is seen from an angle. I also started two more, effects on the heat, and a landscape with pollard birches. The other day, I saw a colored piece of cloth woven in the evening. I'll take you there when you come here. When I saw it, they were also just arranging the warp thread, so I saw a dark, bent figure standing out against the light and against the color of the cloth. The big shadows of the lad, the beams of the loom cast on the white wall. Goodbye. Write soon if you can. Yours sincerely, Vincent. Dear Theo, I want to tell you that I'm working on the potato eaters. I've painted new studies of the head. The hands especially are greatly changed. What I'm trying to do most is to bring life into it. I wonder what Fortier will have to say about it when it's finished. The Lemaitre descent was superb. I'm very enthusiastic about them. They're full of sentiment, calculated both in general and in detail, but especially broadly conceived and treated vigorously. I hope you'll watch for the new months of the series being published. Tell me, please, what's the best way to send a picture of a somewhat large size and what address it should be sent to? I'll not send the potato eaters unless I know for sure that there's something in it. But I'm getting on with it. I think there are completely different things in it. Something that you have never seen in my work before, at least so distinctly. I mean the life, especially. I paint this from memory on the picture itself, but you know yourself how many times I've painted those heads, and I drop in every night and correct some details on the spot. But in the picture, I give free scope to my own head in the sense of thought or imagination, which is not so much in the case of studies where no creative process is allowed, but where one finds food for one's imagination and reality, in order to make it exact. You know, I wrote to Monsieur Fortier. Up till now, I said I've made only studies, but the pictures will come, and I will stick to that. I intend to send a few more studies from nature, too. This is the second time the saying of Delacroix has meant so much to me. The first time was the theory about colors, but later I read a conversation he had with other painters about the making, namely the creating of a picture. And his story was that he pretended the best pictures are made from memory. A parkour, he said about that conversation. I read that when all those worthy people were going home in the evening, Delacroix, with his usual vivacity and his passion, he loudly called after them in the middle of the boulevard, Parkour, Parkour! Probably to the great astonishment of the respectable passers-by, just like Jacques, who after having spent a night with a friend, kept on sending him messages by his boy after midnight all through the night and said, I herewith have the honor to assure you once again that your Monsieur Ang is only an image maker, and that Daumier surpasses him infinitely, or something like that. I will not send the picture before I've heard from you. In fact, it's not quite finished yet. The most difficult things, the head, the hands, and the ensemble, they're finished. Perhaps you'll find in it what you wrote some time ago, that though it is personal, yet it will remind you of other painters with a certain family resemblance, which you didn't find in my studies then. But I think if you compare my studies with other studies, there would also be a resemblance. Well, goodbye with a handshake. Ever yours, Vincent. Dear Theo, last Sunday I saw for the first time the two large pictures by Rubens. And as I looked at those in the museum repeatedly and at my ease, these two, the deposition from the cross and the elevation of the cross, they were the most interesting. The elevation of the cross is a peculiarity that struck me at once. That is, there's no female figure in it, unless on the side panels of the triptych. Consequently, it's none the better for it. Let me tell you, I love the deposition from the cross, but not because of any depth of feeling, such as one would find in a Rembrandt or a picture by Delacroix, or a drawing by Millet. Nothing touches me less than Rubens expressing human sorrow. To explain my meaning more clearly, let me begin by saying that even his most beautiful weeping Magdalene or Mater Dolorosa, they always simply remind me of the tears of a beautiful prostitute who's caught a venereal disease or some such misery of human. As such, they're masterly. But one must not look for more in them. Rubens is extraordinary in painting ordinary beautiful women, but he is simply not dramatic in expression. As for this one, I absolutely must insist on your sending me at least another 50 francs. At present, I'm losing weight. Moreover, my clothes are getting too shabby, etc. You know yourself it isn't right as it is, yet I feel sort of confident that we shall pull through. But you wrote that if I fell ill, we should be worse off. I hope it will not come to that, but I should like to have a little more ease just to prevent illness. Just think how many people there are who exist without ever having the slightest idea what care is, and who always keep on thinking that everything will turn out for the best, as if there were no people starving or completely ruined. I begin to object more and more to your pretending to be a financier and thinking of me exactly the opposite. All people are not alike, and if one doesn't understand that, in drawing up accounts, some time must have passed over the account before one can be sure to account it right. If one doesn't understand this, one is no calculator. And a broader insight into finances is exactly what characterizes many modern financiers, namely, not pinching, but allowing freedom of action. Well, goodbye. Thank you for the Concord book. It was fine. Ever yours, Vincent. Dear Theo, I've been thinking, when you remember that I painted old Tom Dee's portrait, he also had the portrait of the old lady which they sold, and of their friend, it's true I got 20 francs from him for this latter portrait, and that I have bought with discount 250 francs worth of paint from Tom Dee, on which he naturally made something. Finally, I have been his friend no less than he has been mine. I have good reason, though, to doubt his right to claim money from me. It's really squared by the study he still has of mine, all the more so because there was an express arrangement he should pay himself by the sale of the picture. By some queer freak of nature, Zen Pete, Mother Tangi, and some other good ladies have heads of silex or flint. Certainly these ladies are a good deal more dangerous in the civilized world they go about in than the poor souls bitten by mad dogs who live in the Pasteur Institute. And old Tom Gee, he'd be right 100 times over if he killed his old lady. But he won't do it. He won't do it any more than Socrates. And for this reason, old Tom Gee has more in common in resignation and long-suffering, anyhow, with ancient Christians and martyrs and slaves than the present-day robbers of Paris. Now, that doesn't mean that there's any reason to pay him the 80 francs, but it is a reason for never losing your temper with him. Even if he loses his, when, as you may do in this instance, kick him out, or at least turn him away. It certainly is a strange phenomenon that all artists, poets, musicians, painters, are unfortunate in material things, the happy ones as well. What you said lately about Guy de Maupassant is fresh proof of this. That brings up again the eternal question. Is the whole of life visible to us, or isn't it rather this side of death? We see only one hemisphere. Painters, to take them alone, dead and buried, speak to the next generation or to several succeeding generations through their work. Is that all, or is there more to come? Perhaps death is not the hardest thing in a painter's life. For my own part, I declare I know nothing whatever about it, but looking at the stars always makes me dream a little, as simply as I dream over the black dots representing towns and villages on a map. Why, I ask myself, shouldn't the shining dots of the sky be as accessible as the black dots on the map of France? Just as we take a train to get to Tarascon or Rouen, we take death to reach a star. Why, I ask myself, shouldn't the shining dots of the sky be as accessible as the black dots on the map of France? Just as we take a train to get to Tarascon or Rouen, we take death to reach a star. One thing undoubtedly true in this reasoning is that we cannot get to a star while we are alive, any more than we can take the train when we're dead. So it seems to me possible that cholera, gravel, tuberculosis, cancer, are the celestial means of locomotion, just as steamboats, buses, and railways are the terrestrial means. To die quietly of old age would be to go there on foot. Now I'm going to bed because it's late. I wish you good night and good luck. A handshake, ever yours. Vincent.
My dear Theo,
work engrosses me so much that I can't manage to write letters. I should have liked to write Gauguin again, but I'm afraid he's worse than you said he was. His last letter in pencil looked very much as though he were. To my amazement, I can already see the bottom of my purse, though it's true that I have had to pay my month's rent. You must realize that when I take the money for food and lodging out of it, all the rest goes into canvases. Altogether, these are pretty expensive, not counting the trouble they give. But I dare say, someday we'll get back part of the money we spend. If I had more money, I'd spend even more trying to get more rich coloring. I'm in the middle of reading Balzac, de César Birotteau. I'll send it to you when I finish it. I think I'll read the whole of Balzac again. When I came here, I hoped it would be possible to make some connection with art lovers here, but up to the present, I haven't made the least progress in people's affection. And Marseille? I don't know. That may very well be nothing but an illusion. In any case, I've quite given up gambling much on it. Often whole days pass without my speaking to anyone except to ask for dinner or coffee. And it's been like that from the beginning. Up to now, the loneliness hasn't worried me much, because I found the brighter sun and its effect on nature so absorbing. But write me a day, or too early if you can. The end of the week will be rather tough. With a handshake, ever yours, Vincent. My dear Theo, thank you 1,000 times for your kind letter and the 300 francs it contains. After some worrying weeks, I've just had one of the very best, and just as the worries don't come singly, neither do the joys. For just because I'm always bowed under the difficulty of paying my landlord, I made up my mind to take it gaily. I swore at the said landlord, who after all isn't a bad fellow. I told him that to revenge myself for paying him so much money for nothing, I would paint the whole of his rotten joint so as to repay myself. Then to the great joy of the landlord, or the postman whom I already painted, of the visiting night prowlers and of myself for 3 nights running, I sat up to paint and went to bed during the day. I often think that the night is more alive and more richly colored than the day. Now, as for getting back the money I paid to the landlord by means of my painting, I don't dwell on that. The picture is one of the ugliest I have done. It is the equivalent, though different, of the potato eaters. I have tried to express the terrible passions of humanity by means of red and green. The room is blood red, dark yellow, green billiard table in the middle, 4 citron yellow lamps with a glow of orange and green. Everywhere there's a clash and contrast of the most disparate reds and greens, in the figures of the little sleeping hooligan, in the empty dreary room, in violet, in blue, the blood red, the yellow green of the billiard table, for instance, contrast with the soft, tender Louis XV green of the counter on which there's a pink nosegay, the white coat of the landlord awake in the corner of that furnace turned citron yellow or pale luminous green. I'm making a drawing of it with the tones and watercolor to send to you tomorrow and give you some idea. And it's not color locally true from the point of view of the delusive realist, but color suggesting some emotion of an ardent temperament. When Paul Mann saw at the exhibition the violent inspired sketch by Delacroix that we saw at the Champs-Élysées, that the barge of Christ, he turned away from it, exclaiming, "I didn't know that one could be so terrible with a little blue and green." Hokusai rings the same cry from you, but he does it by his line, his drawing, just as you say in your letter. The waves are flaws, and the ship is caught in them. You feel it. Well, if you make the color exact or the drawing exact, it won't give you sensations like that. Anyhow, very soon tomorrow, the day after, I'll write you again about this, and I'll answer your letter, and I'll send you a sketch of the night's cafe. Oh, Tassé's parcel has arrived. I'll write tomorrow on the question of the coarse grain paints. Millier is coming to see you and pay his respects one of these days. He writes me he's coming back. Thank you again for the money you sent. If I went first to look for another place, would it not very likely mean fresh expenses, equal at least to the cost of moving? And then, should I find anything better all at once? I'm so very glad to be able to furnish my house, but it can't help me on. Many thanks. A good handshake. Till tomorrow. Ever yours, Vincent. My dear Theo, at last I can send you a little sketch, give you an idea of the way the work is shaping up. For today, I'm all right again. My eyes are still tired, but Then I had a new idea in my head, and here's a sketch of it. Another size 30 canvas. This time, just simply my bedroom. Only here, color is to do everything, and giving by its simplification a grander style to things is to be suggested here of rest or sleep in general. In a word, looking at the picture ought to rest the brain, or rather the imagination. The walls of pale violet, the floor of red tiles, the wood of the bed and chairs of the yellow of fresh butter, the sheets and the pillows light greenish citron, the coverlet scarlet, the window green, the toilet table orange, the basin blue, the doors lilac. That's all. Nothing in the room with its closed shutters. The broad lines of the furniture again must express inviolable rest. Portraits on the walls, and the mirror, the towel, some clothes, the frame. There's no white in the picture. Who will we want? This by way of revenge for the enforced rest I was obliged to take. I shall work on it again all day, but you see how simple the conception is. The shadows and the cast shadows are suppressed. It is painted in free, flat tints like Japanese prints. It's going to be a contrast, for instance, to the Tarascon Diligence and the Night Cafe. I'm not writing you a long letter here because tomorrow very early I'm going to begin in the cool morning light so as to finish my canvas. How are the paintings? Don't forget to tell me about them. I know you'll write one of these days. I'll make you sketches of the other rooms too someday. With a good handshake. Ever yours, Vincent. My dear Theo, January 23rd. Thank you for your letter and a 50-franc note it contained. Of course, I'm now safe until the arrival of your letter after the first. What happened with that money was entirely due to pure chance and misunderstanding, for which neither you nor I are responsible. But just the same as chance, I couldn't telegraph, as you said, because I didn't know if you were still in Amsterdam or back in Paris. It's over now with the rest, and is one more proof of the proverb that misfortunes never come singly. The great thing now is for you to make sure that your marriage should not be delayed. By getting married, you will set mother's mind at rest and make her happy. Whatever I think on other points, our father and mother were exemplary as a married couple. I shall never forget mother and father's death when she said only one little word. It made me begin to love dear old mother more than ever before. In fact, as a married couple, our parents were exemplary, like Roulin and his wife, to cite another instance. During your hasty visit, did you see the portrait of Madame Ginoux in black and yellow? That portrait was painted in 3/4 of an hour. I have to stop for the moment. The delay of the money was pure chance. Neither you nor I had anything to do with it. A handshake. Ever yours, Vincent. My dear brother, I am working in my room at full speed. It does me good and drives away, I think, these abnormal ideas. So I've gone over the canvas of my bedroom. That study is certainly one of my best. Sooner or later, it must be re-canvassed good and solid. It was painted so quickly and is dried in such a way that the essence evaporated at once, and so the paint's not firmly stuck to the canvas at all. That'll be the case with other studies of mine, too, which were painted very quickly and very thickly. Besides, after some time, this canvas always decays and can't bear a lot of impasto. You've got some excellent stretches. Damn, if I had some, I'd like to work on them right here. It'd be better than these lathers you get with warp in the sun. They say, and I'm very willing to believe it, that it's difficult to know yourself. But it isn't easy to paint yourself, either. I'm working on 2 portraits of myself at the moment, for want of another model, because it's more than time I did a little figure work. One I began the day I got up. I was thin and pale as a ghost. It's dark violet blue, the head whitish with yellow hair, so it has color effect. But since then I've begun another one, 3/4 length, light background. I'm touching up the studies this summer. Altogether, I'm working from morning till night. My strength is returning from day to day. I feel again I already have almost too much. For it isn't necessary to be a Hercules to stick assiduously to the easel. My dear brother, it is always in between my work that I write to you. I'm working like one actually possessed. More than ever, I'm in a dumb fury of work. I think that this will help cure me. Perhaps something will happen to me like what Eugene Delacroix spoke of, I discovered painting when I no longer had any teeth or breath, in the sense that my distressing illness makes me work with a dumb fury, very slowly, but from morning till night without slackening, and the secret is probably this, work long and slowly. How can I tell, but I think I have one or two canvases going that aren't bad. First, the Reaper and the yellow and the portrait against the light background. That'll do for the people who have ordered it, the Vistingate, if indeed they remember me at the right moment. But then I'm absolutely indifferent to it all. Perhaps it's even preferable they should forget me. I'll go on working very hard, then we'll see if the attack returns about Christmas. And that over, I can see nothing to stop my telling the management here to go to blazes and returning to the north for a longer or shorter time. To leave now, when I judge a new attack next winter probable, that is to say in 3 months, would perhaps be too risky. It's 6 weeks since I put a foot outside, even in the garden. Next week, however, when I have finished the canvases I'm on, I'm going to try. Only a few more months and I'll be so flabby and stupid that a change will probably do me a lot of good. I am struggling with all my energy to master my work, thinking that if I succeed, it will be the best lightning conductor for my illness. I take a lot of care of myself, shutting myself up carefully. It's selfish, if you like, not to get used to my companions in misfortune and go see them. But I find myself none the worse for it. For my work is progressing, we have need of that. For it is more than necessary that I should do better than before. For that is not enough. Now, what is it really that we're beginning to catch a timid glimpse of, original and enduring? Portraiture. You may say that that's an old story. But it is also new. We shall talk of this again, but let's keep looking out for the portrait, especially by artists such as Guillemin, the portrait of the girl by Guillemin. Carefully keep my portrait by Russell I'm fond of. Have you framed the portrait of Laval? I don't think you told me what you thought of it. I thought it amazing, the look of the eyes through the glasses. Such a frank look. I must ask for the following thing, Theo, for painting. 10 meters of canvas, large tubes, 6 tubes, zinc white, 2 tubes, emerald green, 2 tubes, cobalt, small tubes, 2 carmine, 1 vermilion, 1 large crimson lake, 6 martin brushes, black hair. I'm eating and drinking like a hog now, and I must say, the doctor is very kind to me. Yes, I think it's a good idea to go and do some pictures for Holland and for Mother and for our sister. That'll make 3. That's to say, the Reaper, the bedroom, the olives, wheat fields, cypresses. That'll make 4 even. For then I have still another person for whom I should like to do one. Of course, I'll work on this with as much pleasure as for the family of the Vingis, and with more calm. Since I have the strength, you may be sure that I'm going to try to polish off some work. I'm choosing the best from the 12 subjects so that the things that are going to get will be really a little studied and well chosen. And then it does one good to work for people who don't know what a picture is. A good handshake for you and Joe. Ever yours, Vincent. Dear brother and sister, Joe's letter was really like a gospel to me, a deliverance from the agony which had been caused by the hours I shared with you, which were a bit too difficult and trying for us all. It was no slight thing when we all felt our daily bread was in danger. No slight thing when, for reasons other than that, we felt that our means of subsistence were fragile. Back here, I still feel very sad. Continue to feel the storm which threatens you weighing on me too. What was to be done? You see, I generally try to be fairly cheerful, but my life is also threatened at the very root, and my steps are wavering. I feared not altogether, but yet a little, that being a burden to you, you felt me to be rather a thing to be dreaded. But Joe's letter proves to me clearly that you understand, for my part, I'm as much in toil and trouble as you. There, once back here, I set to work again, though the brush almost slipped from my fingers. But knowing exactly what I wanted, I've painted 3 more big canvases since. They are vast fields of wheat under troubled skies. I didn't need to go out of my way to try to express sadness and extreme loneliness. I hope you'll see him soon, for I hope to bring him to you in Paris as soon as possible. Since I almost think that these canvases will tell you what I cannot say in words, the health and the restorative forces that I see in the country. Since the third canvas in Daubigny's garden, I've had a picture I've been thinking about since I came here, and I want to do it. I hope with all my heart that the intended journey will give you a little distraction. I often think of the little one. I think it's certainly to bring up children better to bring them up than to give all your nervous energy to making pictures. But then I am, at least I feel I am, too old to retrace my steps or to desire anything different. That desire has left me, though the mental suffering of it remains. I'm very sorry not to have seen Gilman again, but I'm glad he's seen my canvases. If I'd waited, I should probably have stayed talking with him so long that I missed my train. Wishing you luck and courage and comparative prosperity, I beg you to tell Mother and our sister that I think of them very often. Also, I had a letter from them this morning, and I'll answer it soon. Handshakes and fond, ever yours, Vincent. Two days later, Vincent van Gogh walked into this field, the one that he painted with the ominous skies, and shot himself. He died early in the morning of July 29th. This is a letter from Theo to their mother. One cannot write how grieved one is, nor find any comfort. It's a grief that will last, and which I certainly shall never forget as long as I live. The only thing one might say is that he himself has the rest he was longing for. Life was such a burden to him, but now, as often happens, everybody is full of praise for his talent. Oh, Mother, he was so my own brother. During this past week, we celebrated Hope Day on Thursday. I think Van Gogh's works, his paintings and his drawings, and his letters can really be interpreted also as evidence of monumental hope. I don't think his life and his death should be viewed as a tragedy, but rather as a kind of a triumph over despair. After I read these letters last Saturday night, someone came up to me and asked me, what would his art have been like had he lived, had he not committed suicide? Well, I guess I'd never asked the question myself, and I started to think about it. I think that the question really overlooks the completeness of a human being that we discover in Van Gogh's letters and in his paintings, and they reveal a very full and rich and sympathetic soul. Let me close by showing some of Van Gogh's paintings as a statement of hope, or as statements of hope, and some kind of fulfillment. Also, I would like to read a quote which Carol gave this afternoon from the book The Theology of the Pain of God by Kitamori. The pain of God disposes our sin, clinging to our enjoyment. In 10 minutes ago, Fig was running the last couple of minutes of the tape of Saturday night when I read some letters of Vincent van Gogh. I ended that evening session with a quote that I heard just earlier that day from Carol's session on the demonic and the pain of God. And it was a quote by Kitamori, and if I can remember it, it was something to the effect that, I might have to have you play it again. The pain of God reduces the sin of our enjoyments. Now, I don't know exactly.